The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the first of three Science Weekly special editions looking at the scientific, technological and sociological challenges around food, energy and water sustainability. Hosted by Joe Confino, executive editor of The Guardian and director of Guardian Sustainability, an expert panel discussed the entwined relationships, the nexus, between the world's water supplies, food production and the energy needed to produce the water and food to feed a growing planet. This debate, looking at water and food, was originally live-streamed on guardian.co.uk in February of 2013, and it is brought to you in association with the brewer SAB Miller.
This first debate is looking at the connections between water and food. And we know that the world's population is rising rapidly, is going to hit 9 billion. And at the same time, for the first time actually in history, we're going to have the demand for water exceeding the supply. So clearly, there's some very, very important issues we need to face. To discuss these issues in the studio today, we've got a fantastic panel. So I'd like you to welcome, first of all, Sir Gordon Conway, Professor of International Development at Imperial College London, Andy Wales, Senior Vice President for Sustainable Development at the Brewers SAB Miller, and Dr. Tim Fox, who's Head of Energy and Environment for the Institution of Mechanical Engineers. So welcome to all of you. Before we started, we asked each of the panellists to come with one issue that they feel really passionate about. So we're going to start off with you, Tim. And this is going to be even better than the Oscars because the envelopes are bigger. So could you just open your envelope and show us the issue that you brought?
Right, yes, this is an excellent envelope. So the issue that I'm going to be discussing today primarily is food loss. And the key point here, Joe, is that people really probably don't quite understand what food loss is. They'd be familiar with food waste, which we're familiar with here in developed economies. But food loss is all about the food that is spoilt in the food supply chain between the field and the consumer and the marketplace. And essentially, those food losses can be quite extensive, and they largely occur in developing economies and developing countries rather than in mature developed economies like our own. We've got very efficient at getting food from the farm to the marketplace, but in developing economies, issues such as inadequately engineered storage facilities, poor transportation, poor product handling at the point of harvest means that much of the crop, something like 30 to 40% of crop is lost between the field and the marketplace. And of course, when you lose crop, you're not just losing food that's available for nutrition, but you're also losing energy and indeed water. And a staggering figure is that something like a quarter of the world's water that is taken by humans for our use is actually used in food that is either wasted or lost. And a substantial part of that is the lost food.
And do you think one of the problems is that people just don't understand? We hear, of course, talk about the nexus. Is there a problem with the fact that people don't really understand those interconnections? So people think of food waste, but they make no connection to actually energy and water. How important is it to understand that, and what impact could that have?
Well, from an engineering perspective, it's absolutely critical. As engineers, we're called upon continuously to deliver more energy, more water, and to make better use of land resources. And one of the questions we might ask is some of that extra requirement really, really necessary? And that's really was our starting point for our recent piece of work, our report, Global Food Waste Not Want Not, was largely based on asking the question, well, as we face this challenge going forward of feeding 9.5 billion people and looking to increase food production, which requires extra energy, water and land, how much of that is really necessary? Because as engineers, we need to deliver that in a sustainable way.
Are there any particular examples, you say, where the waste is particularly bad?
Well, for example, food losses in India. Something like 30 to 50% of the annual fruit and vegetable crop doesn't make it to the marketplace. So it's not available for people to go to the market and buy. And so the energy and water that has been put into that is lost and could be used for other human endeavours. And sort of in terms of numbers, if you think about 500 million cubic meters of water, which is about an eighth of what we consume in the world, is lost on crops. And this is really down to very basic engineering. This is down to things like grain stores being robust enough to keep the weather out, to keep the rodents out. It's about the food being picked in the field correctly and transported correctly so that it doesn't get bruised and spoiled.
Okay. Andy, I mean, obviously, your business relies on agricultural produce. This issue Tim's brought up, how important is that from your perspective, seeing what's going on in the world?
Well, for any business that's based on agriculture, I think it's very critical. I mean, if you think about it from a business perspective, you can see that as lost value. I mean, we're all about providing high-quality goods and services to consumers. And if a good chunk of the value that we could provide to consumers is actually lost along the way, then that's a waste for everyone. And one of the biggest problems, I think, in the environmental movement and amongst those in business and different sectors that are passionate about sustainability is that so often the narrative has been a negative one about it's going to cost us more to solve this problem. And actually, when you think about the immense amount of food waste that we've talked about, actually, there's a huge opportunity there. I mean, McKinsey republished a report a couple of years ago called The Resource Revolution that looked at how much money was on the table for all of us globally if we could become dramatically more resource efficient. And what they found was that it was something like $3 trillion globally. And in the context of the current financial crisis, the economic debates we're having, that's a significant number. And so if we can actually access some of that waste, make it much more, you know, utilised through the value chain, and at the end of the end, you know, post-consumer here, waste less in the developed world, then actually that's a lot less value that's lost to society, value lost for business.
Okay, but Tim, how are we going to change, you know, it's all very well saying, we need better technology, we need better infrastructure, we need better engineering.
Yeah.
But those are words.
Yes.
The fact is that we don't have them, and there are reasons we don't have them. How are we going to change that?
Well, it's in terms of technology and know-how, we do actually have the sort of know-how and the engineering knowledge and the technologies to be able to do that. In terms of assisting with reducing losses in developing economies, the challenge is really about how we transfer that knowledge and that expertise. So how do we get knowledge that is available, fully available within the engineering and technical profession in developed mature economies, how do we transfer that effectively to developing economies? And there are issues there to do with political will, of course, economics, intellectual property rights, these sort of issues. And what we need is some sort of mechanism to enable that to take place. But that mechanism needs to be at a sort of international UN-type level.
Okay. So, Gordon, I wanted to bring you in here because we're going to talk about broader technology issues. Right. But just sticking with this for the moment, there's a big problem already that can be partially solved with existing systems, but they're not happening. Tim talks about new system, new way of getting. Well, how are we going to move from words to action?
Well, it's partly about governments taking a lead and saying we're going to invest in warehouses, for example, where you store the grain and you can get the right temperature and humidity and so on, all the technologies that we know about. And then it's making sure that the private sector will come in and do the building and construction, and that farmers will understand what's going on and will organise through cooperatives to put their grain in those kind of stores. So it's government, it's the private sector, and it's the farmers in cooperatives coming together.
Okay, so that's the principle, but what I'm getting to is what's the process by which this will actually, in 5 years, be a reality rather than just more words?
Well, I think it's already happening. I mean, there are places you can go, you can see, I was in northern Ghana recently, and there were warehouses being built in northern Ghana for the grain. So it's happening, but it's because you've got these different decisions being made by government, by private sector, and by farmers. And getting that together, and then it happens. You can see it. In this case, you can see it physically, because you can see good warehouses being built.
Okay, Andy, very, very briefly, and then we're going to move on.
Well, I think one of the key things here is for those different sectors Gordon talked about to work together much more hand in glove, and that's where projects like Grow Africa, where you have a number of different companies, different donor agencies and governments from different African countries working together to seek to invest in specific growth corridors in Tanzania, in Mozambique, to make sure that when we all come and do this together, it fits together.
Okay, Gordon, let's see what's in your envelope.
Well, my envelope is drought resilience. We're headed for a 4-degree world. In other words, a world that will be 4 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial. We hoped we were going to get to 2 degrees, but it doesn't look like it now. We're going to head for 4 degrees. And we're already seeing the consequences in places like Africa for agriculture. If you go to a 4-degree world, we're probably not going to be able to grow maize in southern Africa. We're not going to be able to grow wheat in northern Africa. In particular, because we get more drought. You know, global warming creates energy, and one of the energies it does is to produce drought. That's another connection there. And so we're going to get a great deal more drought in Africa. And we can tackle that really in one of three ways. We can use ecological processes. We can do something called conservation farming, which means you don't plow the soil. You let the leaves of the corn lie on the ground and rot down. Or through modern plant breeding, you can use a lot of conventional breeding, and it's going on at the moment. For example, you can breed plants with deeper roots so they bring the water up. Or you can engineer micro-irrigation, not great big irrigation schemes, which are highly energy use, but small irrigation schemes on just a little watershed that takes the natural rainfall, channels it, and brings it round. So there's three ways you can tackle drought.
The whole issue of GM, genetically modified food, so there's an enormous controversy and concern over what some people call Frankenstein foods. I mean, what is the role of GM in this?
Well, it's not the magic bullet, but it is going to have a role. There's, for example, I'll give you an example. There is a gene that's being tried out at the moment called a chaperone gene. And when a plant is stressed by drought, all the proteins in the cells don't fold properly. So the cells die. And this gene causes them to fold back the way they should be. So it's a resilience gene, if you like. It allows the plants to recover. Now, that's not, we're not going to use that in the immediate future, although it's being tried experimentally in Africa and elsewhere. But for the longer term, it will be important. But for the moment, it's the conventional breeding that's producing all the drought tolerance that we're seeing at the moment.
Okay, Andy, from SMEB Miller's point of view, I mean, GM offers opportunities, but also enormous, worries about sort of, you know, the impacts it will have later down the line, the unintended consequences. I mean, what's SAB Miller's view of this?
Well, I think the important thing, particularly in the heat of the GM debate, is to stay open-minded about it. And I think what we've lost, perhaps over the last 10 or 15 years in that debate, is some of the benefits had we been more open-minded on both sides. And, I mean, if for a business like ours, because our main feedstock is barley, actually. Barley, you know, malting barley is not a very large global crop in the scheme of things, about 2% of global grain. So not many people are putting much money into research of GM barley types anyway. So it's not such an immediate problem for us. But I do think it's important as we look at some of the challenges in Africa around and elsewhere around climate change and what that will mean for water supply. There's that famous quote from Rachel Kite of the World Bank that says, if climate change is the shock, then water is its teeth. You know, we're going to feel it through water. And so actually, you know, all options should be on the table, properly considered and properly judged, to see how we can deal with the scale of that climate challenge.
OK, thank you. So, Andy, let's get into your envelope. Let's see.
So mine is more with less. And let's unpick that. Let's first of all talk about more. So why do we need more? Well, we're now in a world with about 2 billion middle-class consumers. And by 2030, or maybe just afterwards, we'll see more like 5 billion middle-class consumers around the world. And that's a huge demand in terms of more raw materials to have a higher quality of life. Some of the things that you and I would enjoy, you know, a coffee perhaps in the morning or some meat a few times a week. And that's actually going to put a big strain on the Earth's resources. And therefore, to get that more, we have to get it from dramatically less resource per head. And the concept of resource productivity of more with less has been around for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But actually, I think we're only now beginning to see the real scale at which businesses, large and small, getting their heads around the value opportunity here, as we talked about earlier, can really drive resource productivity. And if I look in our own business, I mean, we have good, tight internal targets. Last year, we reduced our water use per litre of beer by 5%. We reduced our carbon emissions per litre of beer by 10%. That saves us a significant amount of money in our operating cost. But the opportunities in agriculture are even greater. Right. And that's where, you know, from the US, where working with the Nature Conservancy, we've got in some of the farms, we've got water use down by 20% and therefore emissions down by 10%, therefore emissions down by 20% with the water energy link is really significant. Mm. But you can also take it to the other level, to the very, very micro level, where an issue that Gordon works on a lot is cassava. And in Mozambique, 2 years ago, we launched the world's first cassava-based lager. That's a high-quality beer, but instead of using barley, we're using a local crop that's much more drought-resilient, that is, you know, brings many more subsistence farmers into the process. And so we're finding different ways to create more value for consumers, nice beers, nice drinks, but with less impact on the environment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but just to check, I mean, one of the problems, isn't it, is that growing middle class, sort of bigger population, but actually everyone, including you as a company, wants to grow. I mean, isn't there the problem actually that we shouldn't be saying everyone should be able to eat more meat and actually everyone wants to grow, because actually that's at the heart of the problem. So how does a company like yours deal with that dichotomy?
Yeah, well, let me say two things. The first is that I think anyone, and I meet this a lot in the kind of Western environmental debate, anyone who starts a conversation or joins a conversation by saying, you know, you can't grow to key emerging and developing mm-hmm. markets has already lost the discussion. Mm-hmm. Because there's no way that we can say that those consumers around the world, those citizens, shouldn't have access to those things, because we enjoy them every day. And in fact, it's a really important part of improving their quality of life. So the question isn't should they have it or not. The question is how can we enable them to get that? That's my point.
And Gordon, just coming to you on that, I mean, do you agree with that? Or actually, you know, because you know, one of your things is we need new technology to produce more and with less water. But
yes,
isn't there a fundamental problem?
The big issue is really around livestock diets. You know, we've got emerging countries which have got higher incomes per capita, China, India, Brazil, Korea, etc. They are switching towards more Western-style diets, which means milk, eggs, it means poultry meat, it means pig meat, it means lamb, and so on. And all of that requires a huge amount of grain, roughly, very crudely, 8 kilos of grain for every kilo of meat, and a huge amount of water. And so the big issue is, how are we going to cope with that? It's actually more important than coping with the population increase as such. The simple answer is to say we should all become vegetarians. And I don't actually see that politically happening. One possibility is that eventually we're going to be eating meat that's made from soya or some other vegetable protein. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have steaks that look like steaks.
Not as we know them.
Look like steaks, walk like steaks, sing like steaks, but they won't actually be steaks, they'll be soya.
Yeah.
Now, that'll be 10, 15 years from now, but I think that's only going to be the only answer.
Tim?
Yeah, there's an important dimension here, which I think might help with this, and this is this notion of leapfrogging.
Yes.
I mean, we've seen that developing countries have gone straight to mobile phone telephony,
right,
instead of putting in all the infrastructure associated with landlines and desktop computers. And so that's radically changed the way in which farmers operate in the field in African countries, for example. Similar thing happening with solar PV. The use of solar PV in villages to create opportunities to generate electricity for the village, rather than putting in massive infrastructure with centralized power stations and central distribution systems. Now, there are probably many technologies out there that offer the opportunity, and many approaches that offer the opportunity for countries to leap forward and avoid the sort of unsustainable, if you like, dirty development stage that many of the countries in the fully developed world have gone through. And these may lead to an opportunity to reduce the consumption of water and energy so that we can do more with less. So it's about, as an engineering challenge, it's about increasing the efficiency of the systems that we use in developed countries, yeah. So use less water in the processing of our beer, for example, or other foodstuffs. So use less, and we get very good at that. But it's also about opening up possibilities of new technologies, the sort of thing you've just been talking about in terms of meat, for example, and enabling a leap forward into a much more sustainable environment.
And I think another example are tractors. We're moving more and more towards not ploughing the land. That's true in the United States, it's true in England, it's true in Africa. And now we're developing, and I saw some of this last week at Harper Adams University in Shropshire, we're developing small tractors, not much bigger than where we're sitting here, that are electrically powered, are robotic, very light, and they move across the soil and they get rid of weeds or they plant the seed or whatever. And it's a much more efficient way, A, of using energy, and B, actually, it reduces the amount of water.
Okay. But Andy, I want to bring you in here because, you know, everyone talks about technology. Technology is the answer, but actually, for large parts of the world, people don't even know how to plant their seeds already in an efficient way. They don't even know how to irrigate in a basic way inefficiently. So how do we have this interplay between what you're talking about, Gordon, which is great new technologies, but actually hundreds of millions of people don't even have a basic education?
Yeah, but I think that technology actually is very accessible to many people now. So a very good example is in Honduras, where we have beer and soft drinks, and we use sugarcane as a feedstock for both of those drinks. And we work with WWF as part of one of their big programs in that region to send farmers on their mobile phones details of upcoming weather patterns. So they've got live information about when it's about to have a storm or, you know, a particularly heavy weather event. So they can choose not to apply their agrochemicals just before they all get washed off the land, which A, saves them money, B, reduces water pollution, and is an option then for us as we're, you know, we're buying the raw material to understand we've got a much lower footprint. And but so I think those technologies are penetrating rapidly, the same in India, the same across Africa.
Okay, Tim, we can have all these new technologies, but in our minds, we're still wasting all this food. So, I mean, how do we connect all? Because what we're talking about is connections. So we've got technology, we've got ideas, but then how do we actually make them work so that we don't lose the food that we're producing with all this technology? Because there's so many disconnects, aren't there?
Yes, yeah, and I mean, there are two issues and two responses there. I mean, making technology accessible is a key point. And I think we've really learnt that from mobile technology and internet access through tablets and that sort of technology. If you make something easy for people to use, they will adopt it very fast. Yeah. They'll surprise you at how quickly it will get adopted. And there are major opportunities there. So some of this technology sounds very fanciful, but the technology behind a mobile phone is incredibly advanced and complex. And yet we've made it accessible. So there's that kind of notion there, that it's about accessibility, it's ease of use, it's about tailoring it for the local need and what do people actually need and producing that. But in terms of the kind of wider issue about what do we do about the losses that we have today and how do we transfer that knowledge into communities to enable them to improve their storage facilities, improve the way they handle the crop. And this is often things that are very basic and very simple things, like putting some gutters on the building or designing a crate so that you can transfer the product from the field into a truck without handling it unnecessarily. Very simple things. And that's really about transferring knowledge and information. It's about education. It's about awareness. And it's about making local populations aware. So there's an issue there about knowledge transfer.
And there are very simple technologies. There's an example that's been developed in Niger in Africa, where instead of broadcasting huge amounts of fertilizer over the land, you take the top of a Coca-Cola bottle or a Pepsi-Cola bottle or whatever cola you like, you take that top and you fill it with fertilizer and you put it in the hole where you plant the seed. So it's not all over the field, it's just the amount of fertilizer you need, which means you're saving energy. And it turns out when you do this, you conserve water at the same time. So you're hitting all these things. You're getting higher yields, you're conserving energy, you're conserving water, and it's a simple technology which farmers can very quickly pick up.
Great. Thank you. And Andy, I just want to bring this back to the Nexus debate, which is that we've grown up in a world of specialism where we have these silos. And what you're all talking about is the importance of understanding that, but understanding those interconnections. But that, you know, most people don't even know there's a nexus exists, you know, it exists in either an academic level or at a high level, but these aren't filtering down. So how do we, you know, this debate is about all these interconnections, how we need to understand them. How do we get that out into the public domain so it actually starts to filter through into public policy, into corporate behaviour, into consumer knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, I think the two big challenges are consumer awareness and then government policy. On the consumer side, there are some big hidden elephants. The fact that, you know, I live in London, my daily water footprint is something like 4,600 litres of water, which 100 or so I use myself, and the rest are in, you know, the clothes that I wear and the food that I eat and everything else. And so there's an awareness about the impact all over the world of the things that I consume day to day. And although I'm still a big believer in growth, I'm still a big believer that we should expect an improved quality of life using resources, there are many different ways that we can, you know, use the products and services we buy to improve things. Marks and Spencer's work on swapping, you know, instead of throwing clothes away, actually swapping them for a new one and someone else buying the old clothes, I think is a great idea. So I think there are many innovative ways we can engage consumers.
Okay.
I think government's even more important, though, because a lot of governments at the moment are setting their 2020, 2025, 2030 strategies around water and agriculture and energy and infrastructure. And the disaster would be if they were set separately.
Yes.
What we need is governments that set integrated strategies that understand that a resource like water is as important for your economic planning as your financial budgeting. We need to think about environmental resources in a much more fundamental way across government.
Okay, and Tim, how do you feel we're going to drive this understanding so that we don't end up with sort of policies that actually conflict with each other?
Yeah, so avoiding a silo mentality, really, if you forgive the sort of pun. I think really there's a role here for an international global organisation such as the UN and UN agencies to gather information, to gather data and to communicate the nexus and the challenges associated with the nexus. So I think there's a big role there for an umbrella organisation at the global level to take that communication forward. But then there's a very real need at the sort of local level for, as Andy has said, for when we're setting national agendas and policies around our own development and around development overseas, that we should be looking at bringing these things together in a multidisciplined way and not treating them individually. So it's up also to the professions, to the individual professions like engineers, like economists, to move towards working together more closely on looking at the multiple dimensions of solving these issues.
Well, very briefly, what's the key issue of how we're going to get this thinking right into the system?
I think you actually also have to start with the farmer. If you sit down with an African farmer, a woman farmer, say, and you're sitting on her farm, and she'll say, I've got to produce food. I've got to produce food to feed my kids. I've got to produce food to get money so I can send them to school and for medicines. But look at the land. It's dry. It's parched. It's very difficult to grow a crop there. And I can't afford to buy the fertilizer because it's far too expensive. So she's already made that connection. She's making that connection all the time. Mm-hmm. And there are many NGOs, of course, working in Africa, both African NGOs and international NGOs, who get this too. And I think one of the most important things is for governments to listen to what they have to say about what it's really like on the ground and how you can do something about it.
Okay. Tim, we had some Twitter questions come in, so I just want to go to one from Richard Wakeford, who's from the Sustainable Development Research Network. And he says, the nexus is not only about the relationship between water, food and energy, it's also about how land will be used, which flows from property rights, government regulations, incentives and taxes. What examples are there of good and less good use of land by government? So how important, first of all, is the issue of land and land ownership?
Yeah, land use is incredibly important. I mean, we've got something like 15 gigahectares of land on the planet, of which about 10 gigahectares, so about two-thirds of it, is available for useful, productive biomass production. And, of course, a substantial amount of that is needed to maintain ecosystems. So at the moment, we use about 5 gigahectares for biomass for human consumption. So that's for food and for a small amount for energy production. So land is really at the core of this. We can't increase the amount of land. There are limits to the amount of efficiency that we can engage in sort of in use of that land. So the next dimension is really about issues about how politically we transfer ownership and land rights to people to give them vested interest in using that land and towards using that land sustainably. And this is a major concern in countries that are developing, that the land ownership, if it's with the individual at the community level and at the individual level, then it leads to stewardship, it leads to the development of sustainable practices and an awareness and a desire to treat that land differently than if there is
Andy,
ownership.
Thank
there.
You. And I want to bring you in here because there's the whole issue of land grabs that is going. So actually where you have these smallholder farmers who are being actually pushed off the land and it's becoming more industrialised. Again, from a corporate perspective, How important is it? Should we be actually increasing the size? Should we be saying, actually, land grabs are great because actually we increase the productivity? Or actually, are the smallholders really critical to this, to the finding the answers to this problem?
Well, the answer to your last question is yes. And we need to be careful, I think, to separate the discussion about land grabs from the discussion about the scale of agriculture.
Okay.
So on land grabs, I think there's a very interesting alignment, actually, between a number of the NGOs that campaign in this area and the food and beverage businesses that depend on local supply chains. So we buy directly or indirectly from something like 100,000 smallholder farmers just in Africa. It's actually in our interest that they get access to good property rights for their land. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's one of the things we work on quite a lot with different groups, because we need farmers to have the long-term tenure so they can get credit to borrow to invest in their land so we can buy their crops in a long-term sustainable way. So there's a very clear motivation for us for land rights there to be protected. I think that the question about scale is quite a different one, which is that we do have in some ways the kind of notion of the kind of idyllic small rural farmer. In many parts of Africa, let's say. And we do work with many small farmers, but most of the ambitions of those small farmers are immediately to kind of have food for their family and income and education, but beyond that, to grow and to become more successful. Mm-hmm. And so I think over time, we will see small subsistence farmers become small commercial farmers, and over time, they'll have medium and large-sized farms. And we shouldn't necessarily resist that, but we should make sure that, you know, that people aren't being marginalised through that process.
Okay, in relationship to that, Andy, another question from Patrick Knight, who's a deputy head teacher at Sir John Gleed School, and he asks, how can we promote and enable sustainable growth in newly industrialised countries, which embraces the concept of a reduction in our ecological footprint, whilst at the same time enabling these countries to achieve real advances in the average person's standard of living? So, I mean, you touched on that a bit, but you know, at some point, can we have everything? You know, because everyone talks about, oh, well, we want growth and we want higher standards of living. And there are other people who say, I mean, I remember one of the ministers in Costa Rica saying, we've got to start making sacrifices. We can't have everything. We've got this idea we can have everything. How do we deal with these?
Well, I think there may be lifestyle changes that we will see over the long term, like the switch from meat, maybe, that we talked about earlier. But I think the first thing we have to do is grab the waste in the system and grab the value that's on the table. And not be seen in any way to be telling people in emerging markets they can't have what we've got, and we show no signs of giving up. And actually, I think we would be surprised often at some of the innovations that are happening in emerging markets. So we have a big joint venture in China. It's the world's largest single beer brand called Snow, simply because it's the largest beer in China. That business there is one of the most water-efficient businesses within our group. You know, they are very water-efficient compared to some other operations we have, and that's because the government there has set it as a priority. It's because it's an important part, because they understand the local water scarcity they face. And equally, you know, their wastewater standards are extremely high, even compared to European standards from our breweries there. So I think you'd be surprised, actually, at what some emerging markets are doing because they understand the scale of the resource challenge.
Okay, Gordon, just very briefly to follow that up. I mean, do you feel that you talk about becoming more vegetarians, but that's not a political option, really. Are we going to have to make sacrifices? You talk about 4-degree warming. That's going to be catastrophic. Yes. So what can't we have in the future in relationship to the sort of water food debate?
I think it's difficult to specify what we can't have. I think there's going to be a lot of things we can't have. I mean, we are going to be moving towards a leaner world. I mean, we've got to deal with obesity at one end, but at the same time, as Andy says, we've got to encourage developing countries, say in Africa, to get better yields of their major crops and to get better nutrition. We've got 180 million children in the world who are malnourished, severely malnourished. They're stunted. So the problem is doing the two things together. But you can't just sort of simply take all our profligacy here in the West and, so as it were, dump it on Africa and say, oh, we've done it. It's going to be a much more difficult and nuanced political equation that we've got to work towards. It's going to take 20, 30 years to get there, but I think we ought to be thinking about that now.
Okay, thank you. We need to move on, so thank you for the questions on Twitter. Tim, I want to bring in the whole issue of water pricing. So again, when I was talking to the Nestlé chairman, Peter Brabeck, he said this is the key issue. He says everyone concentrates on water as a human right, which he says is absolutely fundamental in terms of hydration and also hygiene.
Yes.
But the 98.5% of water isn't a human right, and actually because it's free, we basically abuse it. Unless you give it a value, actually, we're lost. What's your view of that whole debate?
Yeah, certainly there is a lack of understanding of the value, not just of water, but of food, which, of course, then has a relationship with the value of water and indeed energy. And there is a need to increase the understanding of that value. And, of course, pricing is one way to do that. And what one of the issues is, well, how do we introduce that without creating poverty and being socially, you know, being socially minded to ensure that those that are vulnerable also have access to these resources. But I think the basic premise that we need to send signals that the that these things have more value than we currently think that they are is very important.
But again, principle great, but the reality isn't that what a lot of NGOs fear is that the what's going to happen is that you get private companies who take control of water supplies, and actually the poor do lose out, because as soon as you put a price on something, the rich can pay for it, and so the price can rise and they can still afford it. The poor do suffer. So what's the mechanism for saying that? How could we stop that happening?
Yeah, that's very difficult. And to be frank, it's not really an engineering based topic.
I think
transfer that one.
Throw the hot potato.
Well,
Gordon.
I think the answer in many of these issues is that you have a basic right to so much water or electricity or whatever else it is, and that may be either free or subsidized, and then above a certain threshold you'll then pay through the nose for it. So you'll have a two-tier process. I mean, that's the principle anyway. Yeah, they do that in South Africa, for example, with electricity. You get so much electricity free, and then above that in your house you have to pay for it.
And Andy, you know, again, from a corporate perspective, a lot of companies are saying, well, actually, we're prepared to pay for it because actually our business can't exist if we don't pay for it. But what's SAB Miller's view on all this?
Exactly the same as Peter Brabeck's, I think, from Nestle. I mean, I think what's interesting is you've got business leaders like Peter, like my CEO, Graham Mackay, out there saying, in our value chain, an important resource, water, is scarce, and it needs to be priced more aggressively to make sure it's used properly. And I think, I mean, it's very revealing. When we published the world's first water footprint for a company in 2009, what we did was look all the way through the value chain at the costs of water at different stages. And we paid at that point in South Africa about half a dollar for a meter cubed of water, pretty much an average price around the world. Yeah. It's essentially an engineering cost, a kind of pumping and treating cost, yes, basically. Farmers are paying less than 2% of that for the same volume of water for irrigation. And so you're not getting water priced like oil or another parallel scarce resource. You're just getting water priced in a very basic kind of engineering way. And therefore, that doesn't in any way reflect the scarcity of the resource. Now, I accept the point that there are lots of concerns about how small farmers and individual consumers might be affected if water prices change dramatically. So I think we need to introduce it gradually. We need to do it in quite a smart way. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't start the process, because, you know, otherwise we're going to face some very significant problems.
Okay, but from a consumer perspective, if I go into the pub and I order my pint and they say, well, actually, sorry, the price has gone up because actually the cost of water has gone up. I mean, how do you deal with that sort of relationship where actually if you pay for it, one of your key costs is going to rise and you're going to have to pass that on?
Well, let's face the fact, if you look at our food bills for the last few years, for example, in the UK, that actually prices have been going up anyway because the cost of wheat or something else is going up for bread. So I think that's the reality we face already. The strange situation at the moment is that water is such an infinitesimally small part of the beer price that you would never see it. It could treble or quadruple or go even further, and you'd never actually see it in the end price of a beer because we underprice water around the world so badly.
Okay,
Tim. I think one of the dimensions that we haven't really explored is that by bringing in some kind of pricing, what it does is it drives innovation. Yeah. And it drives innovation in engineering and technology to bring the cost down. You know, there's one thing about price, but there's another issue about cost. What is the cost of providing that? And so if you introduce pricing and you create pressures around that, you will drive innovation. And innovation always needs a driver, and there's nothing that drives innovation harder than trying to beat a cost and trying to bring that cost down. And it really relates back to what Gordon was saying earlier. You know, one way of sort of encouraging innovation is to introduce some sort of mechanism that values these goods. And there's nothing that people will do quicker than copy somebody else's innovation. So if you're introducing innovative approaches, then okay, others will
look to meet it. You're nodding your head very vigorously.
Well, because it'll happen to livestock products, going back to what I was saying earlier.
Yeah.
You know, as livestock starts to be priced according to its, in particular, according to its impact on the environment, more generally, then there'll come the pressure for substitutes for livestock. Yeah. and we start to get our soybean stakes through innovation. So, okay, you know, the pricing will drive the innovation.
Okay. And Andy, I just want to come back to the consumers, or let's call them citizens as they are, because the levers of change are there. There's civil society, there's corporates, there's government, but there's also individuals. And one of the issues seems to be that individuals don't seem to get this as an issue. They don't get water scarcity. And it's like they're completely, you know, in Western society, they expect to open their tap and have water. What's the role of sort of consumers as citizens in driving change? Because fundamentally, if they get it, something might happen. If they don't get it and they complain every time anything happens, then actually that can be a huge political block.
I agree, and I think the role of citizen consumers is absolutely critical. I think we have to reflect reality and understand the fact that people are unlikely to do this from a pure kind of philanthropy perspective or a pure kind of good of the world perspective. They're going to be a what's in it for me, particularly in tough financial times. And that's where the connections between the nexus can be writ small in your own home. I mean, the fact that you have a longer hot shower isn't just an issue for your water supply. It's going to cost you a lot more on heating bills. You know, the fact that, I mean, I think what we should see is, as one idea, you know, is retailers print at the bottom of your receipt, you haven't just got so many Nectar or Clubcard points, but if you wasted, you know, 24% of this food, it ends up in your bin, then you're wasting 35 quid out of the amount of money you've just spent. Yeah. We need to help people understand very sharply the kind of economic cost of the interaction of the water, food, energy nexus in their own lives.
Okay, Gordon, we're coming towards the end of our time, so very briefly, sort of hearing this debate, when you look at this issue, what's the one takeaway you think, actually, of all these things we can do, what's the one that's going to create the greatest leverage early on?
Well, I think there's two. One is what Andy's been talking about, which is about the Western consumer, getting them to understand the nexus. But I think the most important thing is to literally listen to farmers, poor farmers in Africa with their needs, and figure out how you can help them solve their needs and at the same time reduce the amount of water and reduce the amount of energy and reduce the amount of cost that they incur in producing it.
Okay, Tim?
The food.
Yeah, I think my takeaway is that it's less about not being able to have something. It's more about having it in a different way. Right. And I think that's what we've got to get to grips with.
Okay, Andy?
And for me, it's what can I do? So in business, what we in business need to do is work together much more rapidly at scale, pre-competitively, pricing in the costs of externalities into our products and working together to drive these inefficiencies out of the value chain.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
This debate is available to watch in video form on The Guardian's sustainable business site, guardian.co.uk/sustainable-business. Next week, we'll be bringing you the second debate in the Nexus series, looking at the role of water and food in energy consumption. Remember, for breaking science news day and night, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. This podcast was produced by me, Jason Phipps. Till next week, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.